Hare Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 2, Text 27, Chapter Divine, Divinity and Divine Service. Rajastama Prakritaya Samashila Bhajantivai Pitri Bhuta Prajasadin Shri Aishvarya Prajaksava Rajastama Prakritaya Samashila Bhajantivai Pitri Bhuta Prajasadin Shri Aishvarya Prajaksava Rajastama Prakritaya Samashila Bhajantivai Pitri Bhuta Prajasadin Shri Aishvarya Prajapsava Vaishnavis. Students. Raja, the mode of passion. Tama, the mode of ignorance. Prakritaya, of that mentality. Samashila, of the same categories. Bhajanti, do worship. Vai, actually. Pitri, the forefathers. Bhuta, other living beings. Prajesha Adin, controllers of cosmic administration. Shriya, enrichment. Aishvarya, wealth and power. Praja, progeny. Ipsava. So desiring. Translation purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Those who are in the modes of passion and ignorance worship the forefathers, other living beings, and the demigods who are in charge of cosmic activities, where they are urged by the desire to be materially benefited with women, wealth, power, and progeny. Report. There is no need to worship demigods of whatsoever category if one is serious about going back to Godhead. In the Bhagavad Gita, 7:20 and 23, it is clearly said that those who are mad after material enjoyment approach the different demigods for temporary benefits, which are meant for men with a poor fund of knowledge. We should never desire to increase the depth of material enjoyment. Material enjoyment should be accepted only up to the point of the bare necessities of life and not more or less than that. To accept more material enjoyment means to bind oneself more and more to the miseries of material existence. More wealth, more women, and false aristocracy are some of the demands of the materially disposed man because he has no information of the benefit derived from Vishnu worship. By Vishnu worship, one can derive benefit in this life as well as life after death. Forgetting these principles, foolish people who are after more wealth, more wives, more children, worship various demigods. The aim of life is to end the miseries of life and not to increase them. For material enjoyment, there is no need to approach the demigods. The demigods are but servants of the Lord. As such, they are duty-bound to supply necessities of life in the form of water, light, air, etc. One should work hard and worship the Supreme Lord by the fruits of one's hard labor for existence, and that should be the motto of life. Okay, that's the motto of life. One should work hard and worship the Supreme Lord by the fruits of one's hard labor for existence. One should be careful to execute occupational service with faith in God in the proper way, and that will lead one gradually on the progressive march back to Godhead. Lord Sri Krishna, when he was personally present at Rajadham, stopped the worship of the demigod Indra and advised the residents of Raja to worship by their business and to have faith in God. Worshipping the multi-demigods for material gain is practically a perversity of religion. This sort of religious activity has been condemned in the very beginning of the Bhagavatam as Kaitava Dharma. There's only one religion in the world to be followed by one and all, and that is the Bhagavad Dharma, or the religion which teaches one to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead and no one else. Om Jnana Tirandasya Gnanjana Salakaya Chaksun Mitami Natasma Sri Gurve Namaha. Sri Panchakalpa Trivishcha Kripa Sindhu Devicha Patitano Bhavanibhyo Vaishnavo Namo Namaha. Wonders you can do with a ballpoint pen. So we're talking about worship of the demigods and how those in the modes of passion ignorance worship those demigods and also forefathers, the Pitris, or other living beings. There's often some confusion about the role of the demigods, how this plays out in our philosophy. Devotees pretty clearly understand the difference in the worship of God or Krishna and the demigods. Does anybody here want to worship the demigods or think there's a real advantage in that? No hands are going up. So you all understand that. And sometimes we might not think this is very relevant. Like, why are we always talking about the demigods? You know, in fact, those of us from the West, we didn't even know much about the demigods. So, you know, it was very easy for us to reject worship of the demigods because we never had that concept. But yet it is a very prevalent concept throughout the world. In fact, almost all ancient religions and many modern religions accept the idea of demigods and worship those demigods. I mean, and we're not just talking about, you know, the Eastern world, but most of the Western world, much of Europe, recognize the existence of demigods previous to Christianity. the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, the Norse, Aztecs, so many different civilizations. Any of you studied any of these civilizations, like the Greeks? Okay, who are some of the Greek demigods? Who? Hercules? I guess he was a demigod. He was a half. He was a half, wasn't he? Who were the top ones? Zeus. Okay, who else? Poseidon. What was Poseidon the god of?
Water,
the ocean. Who else?
Ares.
God of?
War.
Who else? What was it?
Athena, goddess of wisdom.
Now, do you notice any similarities to these between some of the demigods that we're aware of? What? Poseidon is like Varuna, right? And Athena? Saraswati, the goddess of wisdom. Who is it? Yama, right. Yeah, and so we can see that, you know, these same ideas were there. They had different names, but and the Romans had Jupiter and Minerva instead of Athena. Jupiter was instead of Zeus, but they were very, very similar. Remember in the Norse, or the Vikings, they had Thor and Odin, right? All these. So they're there throughout history. The main exceptions have been in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, who have tended to reject the demigods. In fact, they even reject their existence. That's why, like, people are very bewildered by the worship of demigods. Because we see they either don't see a distinction, like they think worshiping Krishna, worshiping the demigods is more or less the same, which we know it isn't, or they reject the concept completely. So only Vaishnavism, Krishna consciousness, understands we share the monotheistic view, similar to Judaism, Christianity, Islam, that there is one supreme God, but we also understand that there are demigods. They are there. They are appointed agents of the Lord. They work under Krishna. They are his subordinates, but they have real purpose, and we do respect them. We respect them for, as was described here, they're in charge of so many things, the air, the water, the earth, and they are devotees of Krishna. So we might think that we see so many verses that say, don't worship the demigods, just worship Krishna. And Prabhupada quoted from the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which says, you know, the people of small intelligence worship the demigods. So if you're of small intelligence, why do people worship the demigods, particularly in India? Right? I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but anybody who was perhaps born or their families from India, did your families worship demigods? Yeah, very common, right? It's not, I'd say almost everyone. You know, it's so common throughout India that, you know, people worship demigods, they're worshiping Shiva, they're worshiping, you know, whoever, along with Krishna. So, first of all, there's this lack of knowledge. This merging of the role of Krishna and the demigods. There's sometimes this idea that there's they call it the trilogy or triumvirate or something, that there's three. Brahma's the creator, Vishnu the maintainer, Shiva the destroyer. Now, that's true. And they do represent the modes of passion, you know, ignorance, and goodness. But it's not that Vishnu is on the same level as Brahma and Shiva, which is what many people think, because he's actually the creator, the father of Brahma and Shiva. And sometimes there's another misunderstanding that Krishna and all the incarnations, you know, like the Das Avatars, that they all come from Vishnu. In fact, if you just read some book on philosophy or about comparative religions, they might say that. They might say Vishnu is the maintainer and these incarnations come from Vishnu. Now, technically, that is true. But where does Vishnu come from? From Krishna, right? In other words, Vishnu, Narayan, and then all the Purusha incarnations, the Vishnu expansions, Shiradakshay Vishnu, Karnadakshay Vishnu, Garbhadakshay Vishnu, Shiradakshay Vishnu, they all come from Krishna. Because we hear from the Srimad Bhagavatam about all these incarnations are described, and in the very famous verse, Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam. What does that mean? Anybody know what Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam means? probably all know, but no one's going to say, okay. It means that Krishna is the source. The source. Krishna is Bhagavan, the Supreme Person, who is Swayam, the original. The original source that all other incarnations come from. So there's this philosophical misunderstanding. Could someone give me some water? Also, there's a tendency to follow any strong personality. And that's been described here. Not only demigods, but this verse mentions the Pitris, the forefathers, and says Bhuta, which means other persons, living entities. So any strong personality, people tend to follow. The Bhagavad Gita at 4:12 says, men in this world desire success and fruit of activities, and therefore they worship the demigods. Quickly, of course, men get results from fruit of work in this world. So Prabhupada in his purport talks about this a little bit. He says, in this world, human society is mad after temporary things, such as the material opulence of possessing land, family, and enjoyable paraphernalia. To achieve such temporary things, people worship demigods or powerful men in human society. If a man gets a ministership in government by worshiping a political leader, he considers that he has achieved a great boon. All of them are therefore kowtowing. You know what kowtowing means? Like offering your obeisances, you know, or like being very subservient to the so-called leaders or big guns in order to achieve temporary boons. And they indeed achieve such things. So again, this description of how people worship demigods or other great, so-called great people in society, political leaders, people who have power. Thank you very much. Right. In fact, we see this. This is something that's not uncommon. In communist China, especially quite a few years ago, there was a great, powerful leader called Mao Zedong. I don't know if you heard of him. Chairman Mao. Well, one of the rules in China was in every single house they had a big picture of Chairman Mao on the wall. They did. So there were millions and hundreds of millions of pictures. It's almost like worshiping a powerful personality. And whether this be, you know, in some like Stalin or there's Hitler, these great personalities people practically worship. Is it because they have great qualities? No, because they're very powerful. So it's not just political leaders. Think about sports stars, or musicians, or actors and actresses, right? People think, oh, they're so wonderful, they're so great, there's practically a worship. When I was young, I suppose, probably you've heard of the Beatles? Okay, you're not that old, right? You've heard of the Beatles. Well, when the Beatles first became popular, it was just this amazing, incredible, crazy fad. Where people just go nuts practically, like, you know, they just worship them. Like they were just, you know, the greatest thing, like they were gods. So, and in fact, John Lennon, one of the Beatles, famously or infamously said that we're more popular than Jesus, which made a lot of people angry, of course, saying that, but that's how they felt, and that's how they were being treated. Like they almost like they were a great religious leader. So that's there. So that worship is there for anybody who has some of Krishna's opulences, right? Krishna's the source of all beauty, all fame, all wealth, all strength, all renunciation, all knowledge. And when we see people in this material world who have some little bit of that quality, naturally they're going to be followed. Now, that's a very natural thing. So now what about a very important reason that's being discussed primarily in this verse? The desire for material reward, the desire to gain something materially. And it's described here very, very elaborately, the things that people want. Progeny, wealth, power, and Prabhupada says they want more and more, more wives, more children, more. Now, does that mean there's anything wrong with having wives and children and progeny? No. Not for devotees. Because there's a different motive. A different reason for devotees to have these things, to have families, to have children. Every one of you young people that are sitting in this room, you know what the motive of your parents is? For you to be devotees, right? To be Krishna conscious. You wouldn't be in Banna. You wouldn't be in a spiritual school, in a Krishna conscious school, if your parents didn't have that desire for you to learn about Krishna, to worship Krishna, to be in association with devotees. So that's not a material motive, right? So when we're talking about motives to have children or progeny, all that, we're talking about materialists. Materialistic reasons or material motives that is apart from Krishna or apart from devotional service. I just wanted to make that clear. So I mentioned the word motive. I want to talk a little bit about that, about motivation. My academic work was in psychology of learning, educational psychology. Motivation was a big part of what we studied and what we taught. Motivation is the reason, simply put, the reason we do something. Sometimes let's talk about the needs, desires, the wants, the drives of an individual to do anything, to accomplish anything, right? No one does anything unless they have some reason to. They have some motive. Now, one way that we look at motivation is through looking at external or internal motivation, or sometimes we call it extrinsic or intrinsic. Now, this is the educational part of the class here, so, you know, you're going to learn something. Maybe they all know this. No? Okay. What is extrinsic or external motivation? It means activity that is done for an external reward. Simple example, why do most people go to work every day? What do they get? Money, a paycheck, yes. That's called an external reward. You're getting something as a reward for doing that activity. Or it may be to avoid punishment. Now, punishment is used in a very broad sense. Anything that's a negative consequence. Okay, why do I not speed 90 miles an hour down the road? Besides it not being safe, which of course we wouldn't want to do. What other reason? What might happen to me? You'll get a ticket. So in other words, there's a negative consequence. So often people are motivated by getting something that they want positively or avoiding something negative, a punishment, right? Sometimes we behave because of that, right? We're trying to avoid a punishment or we think we might get something. I don't know if you guys have any kind of extrinsic rewards. Does anyone do things like gold stars? No, you don't do that. Okay. One of your teachers says that you focus on internal rewards. That's very good. Okay, just to follow this out the example a little bit more, though, let's look about religious activity, which is what we're really talking about today. What would be an external reward for being pious or being religious? We've been talking about it today in the purport. Fame? Go to heaven. Yeah. Yeah, that's a big thing. Be good, do religious activities, go to heaven. And conversely, if you don't, what happens to you? You might go to hell, but hell is fine. Or we might say in a more broad in the sense of our Vedic understanding, one might want to gain a higher birth. Or might be afraid of getting a lower birth, falling back into animal species of life in their next birth. So these are different examples that are there. Now, let's look at the other one, which is intrinsic or internal motivation. Generally, that's defined as activity that's done out of interest or enjoyment, rather than a specific reward. One feels the activity is meaningful, it has purpose, it gives one satisfaction, right? Let's take doing schoolwork. Lots of that going on, right? What would be some intrinsic motivation, other than, you know, for the grade or not getting yelled at or something, that you might do? You might do a project or an assignment. What would be an intrinsic motivation? Can anybody think? You don't have any. I bet you do. Have you ever found yourself doing some project or doing something and you kind of got interested in it? Does that ever happen? Sometimes? Yeah. Ah, come on. Sometimes. You must have felt some interest in doing some project. I've seen some of you get really into things, you know, and you know, especially some of you, the older students, you know, when you're doing those big yearly projects that they do. I saw some of those, and they're really amazing. I said, because the students got so into those, they got absorbed in it, and it was something that they really enjoyed and really you know, they took pleasure and they took satisfaction and they felt they learned something. They gained something from it. That's intrinsic motivation. So devotional service is beyond material motivation and should be performed in a similar way for its own sake, to please Krishna and not for material reward. Now, I would contend that in spiritual life, there is both extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. Right? Either may be there, or both, or some mixture. So I guess the first question would be, does the spirit soul have motivation? Obviously, in material life, we see that we're motivated. In spiritual life, would we be motivated? Think so? Sure, of course. This is one of the qualities of the soul. In the Paramatma Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami, there's a lengthy description, a couple hundred pages, about, before he talks about Paramatma, he talks about the soul, the Atma, about what are the qualities of the Atma. It's very interesting, because Jiva Goswami says that the Atma is individual, he's self-aware, he has different shaktis, like knowledge, he has an awareness of himself, he pervades the body, gives consciousness. Also says the Atma is enjoyer. Well, we know Krishna is the main enjoyer, but we also have that quality of ananda, right? Sat, chit, ananda. Ananda means bliss. That means there is some spiritual enjoyment that is there for the spirit soul. And we have desire. Prabhupada talks that about a lot. We can read that, how we may have material desire or spiritual desire. Material desire leads us to come to the material world. Spiritual desire gets us out of this material world. So desire is there. That's a motivation. And it's also described by Jiva that the Atma is the doer. He's the cause of action. He has volition, or free will. And being, so that action might be as the pure Jiva in the spiritual world, or conditioned activity in the material world. And because we are Tatashta Shakti, which means that we are marginal, right? We can become covered by material energy. So sometimes we're covered by the modes of nature in connection with Prakriti, material energy, and that motivation may become materially affected. Okay. Now, this is from a purport, Bhagavad Gita 15.7 by Srila Prabhupada. He says, every living entity is an individual soul, has his personal individuality and a minute form of independence. You all have some free will, some independence. But by misuse of that independence, one becomes a conditioned soul, that's us here in the material world, and by proper use of independence, he is always liberated in the spiritual world. In his liberated state, he is freed from material condition and he's under the engagement of the transcendental service of the Lord. In the conditioned life, he's dominated by the material modes of nature and forgets his transcendental loving service of the Lord. So our motivation should be to please the Lord through glorifying him. Right? But we're not always on a pure platform. We may have other motives. So sometimes we may have external motivation even to perform devotional service, believe it or not. What are some of those? Maybe, anybody think why, maybe some of the adults, what would be some material motive why one might perform devotional service, which is pure in itself, but what might be a... What's that?
Success.
Yeah. Wanting to be successful, materially successful. What would that look like? What else? Does anyone ever do devotional service for recognition? Or, so that people think what a great devotee I am? Or, for position? Sometimes we become attached to position. Oh, I'm a big GBC member, or I'm a big kirtan leader, or whatever it might be. I'm a big pujari, right? We could become a little proud. These are all material motivations. This is described in many places, Nectar Devotion, but in Chaitanya Charitamrita Majjha 19.158-160, it says, sometimes unwanted creepers creepers are like, you know, plants growing. Such as the creepers of desire for material enjoyment and liberation from the material world grow along with the creeper of devotional service. In other words, we have what's called, there's the bhakti lata, the seed of devotional service. And the bhakti lata is like this devotional creeper, this growing as we do the watering process of hearing and chanting. But along with that watering process of hearing and chanting, there can be weeds growing. That's what we're talking about. The varieties of these weeds or unwanted creepers are unlimited. Some unnecessary creepers growing with the bhakti creeper are the creepers of behavior unacceptable for those trying to attain perfection. Diplomatic behavior, that means like being political, you know, not being straightforward. Animal killing, which hopefully none of you are doing, none of us are doing that. Mundane profiteering, making money off a devotional service. Mundane adoration, oh, everybody will recognize me. And mundane importance, I am such an important devotee. Right? So these are considered weeds. These are external motivation, extrinsic motivation performing service. So we know that, ideally, devotional service should be free from this material motivation. There's some very, very nice, famous verses about this. And a few verses ago in the second chapter, verse 6 of the Bhagavatam, first canto, it says, Savayapungsang parodharmo yato bhaktir hokshide ahaitu yakapritiyata yayatma supersedity. The supreme occupation, dharma, for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendent Lord. Now here's a description of how that should be performed. Such devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. So in other words, to the degree that our service is unmotivated, unmaterially motivated, to that degree the self will be satisfied, will be happy. And of course, another famous verse in Bhaktivedanta is Sintu 1.1.11, and the Anyabhilashita Shunyam verse. It's described that devotional service, pure bhakti, must be without desires other than that of the service of Lord Krishna or without material desires. And Anushilanam, defined as continuous devotional service to Krishna, is devoid of karma, jnana, and yoga. So, does the devotee have no motivation or no self-interest? Certainly, we have no, the devotee should have no material motivation, but do we have a self-interest? Yes, we do. There is a self-interest. The self being the soul, the atma, there is its natural self-interest. And that's described in the Bhagavatam 5.6.19. Those who unnecessarily engage in bodily conception create an atmosphere of materialism, are always ignorant of their real self-interest. So the real self-interest is described here. And this is a story, this is the part 5.6.19 about Lord Rishabhdev. So it's out of his causeless mercy, Lord Rishabhdev taught the self's real identity and goal of life. Prabhupada says, satisfaction through self-realization is called Svarupananda. The conditioned soul, eternally sleeping in darkness, does not understand his self-interest. He simply tries to become happy by making material adjustments, but this is impossible. It is therefore said in Srimad Bhagavatam, Nidevadu Sartakatemi Vishnum, 7531, which means the goal of life is to engage in service to Vishnu. Due to gross ignorance, the conditioned soul does not know his real self-interest is to take shelter at the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu. So our spiritual intrinsic motivation is based upon the real interest of the soul. The pure devotional service is what we should be performing. And we can think of so many examples of this. Think about chanting Hare Krishna. Think about being in kirtan. Okay. Chanting should be done for its own sake, for its own sake, for the satisfaction of Krishna and for one's own satisfaction. For one's, you know, feeling spiritual connection with Krishna. What would be an example of another reason that one might perform kirtan? Other than pleasure, yeah. Make others connect. Well, that would be a good reason, yes. That would be a spiritual reason. Anything would be a bad, poor reason, bad reason? What? Yeah, exactly. He's saying he's trying to show off or something. Yeah. In other words, if one is more interested in being like, I'm performing some musical event, you know, and I'm such a great kirtan leader like that, that's not the right motivation. So that's a very, very good point. All right, so the motivation should be to please the Lord through glorifying him. And to the degree that we're not completely pure, our motives might be to experience personal happiness, satisfaction, purification, but that's okay. At least, we should try to become satisfied and happy in Krishna consciousness, even if we're not like saying, I just want to purely serve Krishna. Because that's very difficult for the neophyte devotee, for the new devotee. And that's why we have the principles of Vaidhi Bhakti, of sadhana bhakti. And this is described in so many places, Bhakti Samrita Sindhu and others. There's so many of the different rules and regulations of doing sadhana, of chanting Hare Krishna, of hearing and chanting. This is because we are all neophyte. We have mixed motives. You know, what do we call these sometimes? You've heard of karma mishra bhakti or jnana mishra bhakti. This means bhakti, it's devotional service, but it's mixed. Mishra means mixed. Mixed with what? Karma and jnana. Karma means what we've been talking about, material motivation. Jnana means, you know, like speculative knowledge or impersonalism. So if we have these other motives, they might be there in the beginning. We have mixed motives. We're not just pure devotees. But the process of sadhana, the process of hearing and chanting, and the nine process of devotional service purify us so our motives become more and more pure, become less external, extrinsic, and more intrinsic. So all the different rules are given there for Vaidhi Bhakti, and Rupa Goswami, Bhakti Samrita Sindhu. Before he gives those rules, he says there's one main rule. There's one primary rule that all the other rules are meant to serve. And that's actually from the Padma Purana, which is always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. So that's the point. We do all of these things. We hear, we chant, we serve. We do all these things so that we will always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. Now, do any of us always remember Krishna every minute of the day and never forget Krishna? I can't raise my hand for that one either. You know, no, we're probably not. So we may not be. So how do we always remember Krishna? Actually, one thing I felt that gives us a little leeway here, a little grace, is that Vishnu Chakravarti Tagore explains in his purport to that verse, he says that this word satatam, of always remembering Krishna, means we remember every day. Not necessarily at every moment. We can't expect that. He says otherwise, constant remembrance is not possible at the Vaidhi stage, and we would become discouraged and lose faith. Always means every day we need to remember Krishna. So how do we at least remember Krishna every day, if not at every moment? What's the best way to remember Krishna? Chanting, yes. If we're chanting every day, if we're hearing every day. All of you have a class every day? Bhagavad Gita or some class? Some of you? That's how it helps us that we remember Krishna through hearing. We remember Krishna through chanting. And of course, hearing chanting lead to remembering. So if at least every day, sometime during the day, we are performing some activity of Krishna consciousness, of hearing and chanting, we will be remembering Krishna and we'll be progressing, advancing in Krishna consciousness, becoming more and more purified. So we should perform our daily sadhana and remember Krishna by that practice. Remember that our service is not based upon something external or forced upon us, really. Sometimes we might feel that way a little bit, you know, like older people are telling us to do this. But it's based upon the real interest of the soul. It is your self-interest, the spirit soul's interest, to reconnect with Krishna, to remember Krishna, developing our loving relationship with Krishna. That is where we are completely happy and satisfied, if we can develop that relationship with Krishna. And obviously, get out of the suffering of the material world and go back home, back to Godhead. Well, thank you very much for your patience and your attention. Any Thoughts, questions, comments?
If you're working and like you're making money, right? But what if you're like using the money to like buy groceries to make prasadam?
Using the money to what?
Buy groceries to get to make prasadam eventually.
That's obviously devotional service.
So like if we'd like dovetail it all towards Krishna, like,
absolutely.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of like going back to our theme today of motive.
Okay.
Depends on what your motive is, what your desire is. In fact, realistically, we all have to. Krishna says even I have to work. He says he has to set example that way. In other words, we all have our service. We all have our particular dharma, and we have to maintain families, maintain so many things. But if the end is that the family is Krishna conscious, we want to offer our food like that, then we're perfectly situated. It's devotional service. So there's nothing wrong with making money. Prabhupada, very much in favor of making money, as long as it's used for Krishna. Okay. Prabhupada would make a joke. He says, some of these yogis, they say, no, don't let me touch money. And I'm saying, yeah, give me money so I can, spread Krishna consciousness, serve Krishna. Okay. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.